Welcome everyone to this session where I'm really happy to be talking with Victor Lee Lewis. Firstly, Victor, welcome and thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
Victor was just telling me, we were just talking about the interview and he was sort of jumping. I said, don't stop, and I'm super excited to get into what we're going to get into here. I think that this is going to be really powerful, but I think there's also some really practical ideas and wisdom to come from it. Just to give people a bit of Victor's background, Victor Lee Lewis, MA, is the founder and director of the Radical Resilience Institute and Radical Resilience Coaching and Consulting. He is a progressive life coach, trainer, speaker, and social justice educator. His work supports transformative change agents in improving and maximizing their emotional resilience, mental flexibility, and personal performance and effectiveness. Victor brings a unique socially progressive vision to the work of personal growth, personal empowerment, and emotional health. He is a neuro-linguistic programming master practitioner, an NLP health practitioner, an EFT advanced practitioner, an AAMET certified EFT trainer, certified NLP hypnotherapist, and a resilient and thriving trauma survivor. Victor, I think I want to start there. I'd love to, you were just telling me before we started some of your background and some of the formative experiences in your childhood that have really shaped the trajectory of your inner life, but also the roles that you've played in your outer life as well. Maybe just say a little bit, just to open this up, around what was the role of trauma for you in terms of your childhood?
Well, as I had mentioned off camera, I would say trauma was the central emotional axis of my life for at least the first 48 years. The first 3 years, I'm not completely sure about, but when I was 3 years old, trigger alert, very profound, horrific accident occurred that had deep emotional implications, but also social implications for me, because I lost my only sibling in an accident in which I was the agent of her death. That is to say simply that we're playing together. She stuck her head out the window. I pushed a button on an automatic window mechanism in the car that we were sitting in. Window rolled up on her neck. Over a period of a couple minutes while I was completely helpless, she died. I took grave offense to my own participation in that. I was devastated by the loss of my best friend. And for probably 2 years after the initial event, I remember just about nothing. After that, I found myself uplifted, really, by a passionate curiosity, and I would consider that a trauma protective factor. I was just always curious about things, and in particular had a compulsion to read anything with words on it. I don't know if that places me ever so slightly on the autism spectrum or not, but I have some suspicions that maybe there's something having to do with neurodivergence and that. But I read a great deal, and by the time I was 13, I started reading a lot about spiritual growth, personal healing, self-help, psychology, mysticism. And by the time I was 14, 15, 16, that was pretty much my life. But then I became a social activist at 16 in the midst of all kinds of social turmoil. The Vietnam War had just ended. And I went to Kent State University on the fifth anniversary of a traumatic social event for the nation, which was the Kent State University massacre. That changed me forever, so that not only did I have a traumatic personal loss, but I had a traumatic loss of faith in my country. I had a traumatic loss of belief that the Constitution meant what it said, and that our nation's leaders and adults in general were committed to the ideals that they espoused. as a survivor of childhood trauma, I actually concluded that a good many adults were hypocrites. And they didn't recognize or fully appreciate the subjectivity and the capacity to understand adult behavior that children have. And so with in our little bodies and psyches, we sit down, we look up at them, and we think, you're lying. Why do you preach telling the truth? Why do you preach using your words? Why do you preach the things that you say in temple, mosque, and synagogue, church, and you don't live it? This is the way I think a child thought, and I carried that naivete into the fifth anniversary of the Kent State University massacre. My high school homeroom teacher was one of the organizers of the protests which led to that event. So for me, trauma, personal and social, have always been linked. Yes. And understanding trauma, learning about trauma, becoming curious about how do we undo the causes of social trauma and recover from the effects of social trauma, and then how do we heal from the internal consequences, the compromise and the theft of well-being that social trauma imposes on a life. Fast forward to 2007, I had been for 30 years probably thinking about trauma and social change and poverty and childhood development. And ever since the book John Bradshaw and the Family came out and sort of popularized the notion of doing inner child work and talking about the uncanny similarities in the spontaneous responses of the children of alcoholics and of combat veterans. And I was a child of alcoholics, and I said, that is me. I do react like a combat veteran to the death of my sister and so many things since then. You know, I could not bear to have anybody controlling a car window but myself. Without going into some sort of near panic. But in 1993, I participated in a sort of a weekend retreat round table without a table conversation between myself and a group of eight other men of various ethnicities or racialized identities and histories. And that film was called The Color of Fear. It's been seen at least in part by probably 40 million people, having been on the Oprah Winfrey Show and in syndication that way. For a period of time, it was a very prominent tool in all kinds of sectors where people did diversity, social justice, or inclusion, education, cultural competence for clinicians, and any kind of social science class, campus life, government agencies, lots of work. So yes. I traveled around the country, showed this film to tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people. I would say definitely hundreds of thousands of people now. And every single time I showed the film, because it cuts so deep to the hidden core of racialized experience for people of all racial identities, I saw trauma erupting, ab reaction in every single event of size that I screened this film in. And I, even though I believe that I was doing state-of-the-art cultural competence and social justice education work, and I wanted to make it as gentle and as powerful, as rigorous as possible, there came this realization to me that was heartbreaking, which was, we're not doing this right. The way that we're trying to awaken people socially is leading to an intensity of trauma in the field. And in fact, it's uncovering a well of trauma that's always waiting. Every time I show up to do the workshop, there's a bunch of traumatized people. I throw my film on, we start their discussion, and trauma stories and our reactions pop up like mushrooms. So go ahead.
Yeah. There's so many things you said I want to speak to, but I think actually just to respond to what you're talking about here, I was saying to you before we started recording, I haven't had a chance to see the whole film, but I saw some clips of it. And one of the things that really, really did land with me was there was a clip where you were sharing what it's like to be a Black man and not being understood and not being seen in that place in a way that was emotionally intense and strong. But there was something about it that for me, having over recent weeks been on the beginning of a journey of trying to better understand some of these issues, there's something about the emotion and the emotional truthfulness and honesty that sort of cut through theories and ideas and debate. It just sort of hit me in the heart. I wanted to hear a little bit from you. And I think this is the frame you've just shared around having screened that film and had dialogue with so many people. There's something about being seen beyond words, being seen in one's truth of one's experience, which I think is so important. And I think it impacts people differently. Perhaps you could just share a bit about that.
Sure. It was done as a gift, as a conscious act of emotional labor, which I hoped would be multiplied or magnified in its impact, because I would only have to personally and spontaneously do it one time, and then every time somebody put on the video cassette or the DVD, they could join me and the other men in that circle in that visceral experience over and over, without us having to re-engage in the emotional labor in the same way. And when I told the truth, the whole truth is in that moment of my experience of being racialized as Black and male and being considered to be a member of the threatening race, the dangerous race, the suspicious race, the dumb race, the ugly race, the indigestible race, the unintelligent race, the problematic race. And to hear this gaslighting ignorance, which was hard to believe, it was actually ignorance rather than malice and dishonesty. But to hear this profound ignorance of the inequality of my racialized experience versus David's racialized experience, David Christensen, the white man I was speaking to in the film, who didn't realize that he had a race. And that's one of the biggest problems that white people have, is they, two things. They believe that race is a biological reality than a social one, and they believe that Black and brown people have race and that they don't. It's a biological fallacy. It's a socio-political cultural fact with profound life and death implications for the visceral and corporeal realities of Black bodies, which is why Alicia Garza's hashtag Black Lives Matter is so resonant to Black people first and foremost, and to all racialized peoples of color, of course, as well, but now increasingly to white folk. And if I could just say briefly why I think this message is getting through in a way that it never has, I believe, ever in the history of racial discourse. Frankly, this is an inflection point of a 500-year arc of racial historical invention. One of the things that is demonstrated in the way our white people are racialized is that there is an empathic collapse, which I believe has to be in all cases at least somewhat traumatic because of the moral injury in destroying the empathic bridge between people racialized as white and people who are racialized as inferior to them in their social, cultural, and historical training. And in that way, in this empathic collapse, Amy Cooper in Central Park in New York can summon a lynch mob in a spirit of absolute malicious, gaslighting dishonesty, deploying the power of the state to potentially destroy Christian Cooper, an innocent bird watcher who is asking her to leash her dog so as to protect the wildlife in this small sanctuary. So she's wrong, he's right, but because of the racial codes between them, in her mind, here is a member of the governed race who has violated all the rules by asserting governance over a member of the governing race, and that is a capital offense. And that sentence was executed the same day within 4 hours in the person of George Floyd, who whose name is only one letter different from three of my cousins because I have three cousins named George Floyd.
Wow.
The first, the second, and the third. So it's, again, it feels very deeply personal and visceral. What makes The Color of Fear work in any case is that instead of talking about the statistics, I talked from and through, as Kimberly Jones does in a 6-minute whirlwind historical cultural critique that is so fantastic, it humbles everything I've ever done my whole life, that I connected the pie charts and the sociological reports to visceral experience. And that is a difficult thing to do and something that that Black and brown people can do, but usually don't feel willing to do because of the emotional labor and the dishonor that that labor is typically subject to. If we try to tell the whole truth in a completely truthful way, we're out of our minds. We've lost control. We are being aggressive and intimidating. And I was accused in the film of being so, even though I never left my seat and I never even pointed my finger.
One of the things that for me, I think particularly was so powerful about it was it felt like you were in touch with the truth of your feeling of the rage and the anger and the frustration. But it actually didn't feel aggressive. It didn't feel like it was you were attacking someone. It felt like you were speaking your truth, which for me made it all the more powerful somehow.
Yeah, and there was, if I could just make a brief cultural note and tribute to my mom, I was spontaneously modeling. I walk like my father. I turn my head like my father. But I tell the truth in the face of injustice like my mom. Hmm. There's a form of Black girl magic, as we call it, a thing that Black girls and women do that are amazing. But one of those things is speaking truth to power where we don't have physical might and they don't have legitimacy and authority, but that does not stop them. I'm telling all of the truth without a shred of compromise because you can't take anything from them, nothing to lose. So, in order to stop my voice, they say, you'll have to stop my life, and I'm not going to stop my life for you. So I embodied that as a student, as a male student of Black Girl Magic. I just thought, this one time in my life, and I prayed briefly to my grandmother before I spoke, and I mean 2-3 seconds, and I'm like, got her blessing, and I said, here comes. I'm only going to do this once.
But it's beautiful that you could do it once and it could be captured.
Sorry?
It was beautiful that you could do it once and it could be so powerful and captured and then impact so many people.
Yeah. Well, I'm grateful to have been caught up in that moment. I would add that a lot of what made my teaching and training career as a social justice educator, I now identify as a healing justice educator because I henceforth refuse to separate healing of the body and the soul and the body politic from the transformation of policies and social conditions. Both of those processes need to proceed contemporaneously, simultaneously. Yeah,
I think that's an important point, because I think what can happen is people can get overly fixated on one side of that sort of direction and negate the importance of the other side. And actually, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, particularly given some of your own personal history, why is healing our own trauma so important as part of this wider dynamic of addressing these complex and important social issues?
Well, I have a sort of a deep history answer to that question. I believe that the vulnerability to trauma is part of our complicated evolutionary legacy, and that the development of empires and patriarchal societies some 5,000 years ago, and then eventually these feudal and adventuring societies, the seafaring colonialism and all of that stuff, all the way up to the invention of race in 1492 thereabouts, the beginning of the age of European expansion into the all the other continents of the world, that right now, even in 2020, we're at a culmination point, an intersection of all these forces that have been on a great arc that has been saturated with trauma. You cannot establish or maintain an empire of any sort without encoding trauma on the population. That is how we create citizenship and order within empires. Within the Egyptian Empire, within the Roman Empire, within the Greek Empire, the British Empire, the Spanish Empire, they came, they traumatized, they took, they continued to traumatize, and generated narratives that that bury the lie of the trauma under mystification, some kind of mythology. So Christopher Columbus didn't invade the Americas with a team of raping pillagers who spread disease and destroyed the entire population of at least one island. But he is a discoverer.
Yeah.
He discovered how to commit genocide on people far away and to turn that into wealth. And then they discovered how to steal people and treat them as property and chattel to reproduce profit and to hold themselves up as champions of liberty and freedom at the same time. And so at the core of, just fast forwarding to U.S. racialization, which has resonance, it's not the same, but racialized societies all over the world can learn from what I'm about to say here. At the core of the baseline mainstream white identity is a set of defenses creating an emotional distance and a visceral distance between the tragedy, the trauma, and the horror of genocide of the indigenous peoples of the Western Hemisphere and the enslavement, the kidnapping, the enslavement, and the grotesque dehumanization, the monstrous dehumanization of Black people for the sake of white freedom and guilt. And the construction of white American identity is impossible to comprehend outside of those traumatic tragedies, those moral horrors and abominations, and white people's willful refusal to take any ownership of being the heirs to that legacy and the beneficiaries of that violence, which is ongoing.
Yeah, I hear that, and I also raises another question of how do we do better in creating dialogue and because what I'm hearing you say I think is very powerful and I think it's very important, and I think speaking as a privileged white male, it's very easy to go, oh well, that's just the past, that wasn't my fault, that sort of happened, and that clearly doesn't help things move forward. One has to own one's legacy and one's history. And what facilitates that? What helps that process?
Well, first, I think it's helpful to realize that creating racial justice or understanding how human beings are racialized, this is a form of violent and destructive domestication of all human beings who have had a racial identity imposed on them, including white people. And what it costs you is, one of the conversations that needs to be had is what it costs white people to accept the role and identity of whiteness and the social advantages that are associated with that. The privilege, the unearned benefits that go with being coded as a white person in our societies. To have a good learning conversation, we need to recognize that race is not a biological reality. It's a sociological one. And that racial identities are learned. They can be transformed. That we can reflect back on how we've been racialized as people of color, how we've been racialized as white, how this process is was designed to justify the deep financial self-interest of wealthy governmental and religious and civil elites. But it actually captured the whole culture in this trajectory of racialized wealth production and extraction. It is at the heart of the engine of capitalism. All capitalism is racial capitalism and racially exploitative. So getting developing a willingness to go to school is important. And for white people to embrace what I would call cultural humility, like you don't know, and you don't know what you don't know, so it'd be in your interest to listen so you could find out what it is that you don't know and why it's important to you to undo racism. Because while you're trying to protect your racial reputation and the reputation of your ancestors, your racial clinging and the reproduction of social stratification and super exploitation of the global South and racialized Black and Brown people all over the world, including in Western societies, all of that process is at the heart of the engine of climate chaos and the destruction of everything that you love. So if Black and Brown people don't make it today, if you do not stand in solidarity with us today, by the time you realize that you should have, it will be too late for you. And those, and the signs of that global breakdown are already evident to many of us. For some of us, it's been for decades, and for others, it's only happening in the last few weeks. But make no mistake about it, the coronavirus pandemic is a reflection of climate chaos, and the racialized and economically stratified impact of coronavirus, the way that it kills Black and brown people at a much higher rate, has everything to do with the way the project of racialized expansion of the descendants of Europe and Europeans themselves for the last 500 years. But that is collapsing. All of the stratifications, as well as the interdependence, are coming to light. And the last thing I want to say, and I'm going to give you your mic back, is that King made it plain in his letter from Birmingham jail when he said that we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied in a single garment of destiny. What affects one directly affects all indirectly. And this was the brilliant gem that he dropped after he said, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." So having a collaborative rather than a competitive and argumentative conversation about race is the way to get it done. We have the conversation slow. We have it patiently. We have it honestly and courageously, and we have it for the sake of understanding rather than for the sake of victory.
I think that's very powerful what you're saying. And I think one of the things that I think is a really interesting reflection at this point is what I think seems to be changing is it seems that more white people are starting to recognize, hang on, I've been missing something, like something is going on here. But It's taken a great deal of continued suffering and escalation of that to somehow reach a point where it's been able to penetrate the sort of cultural narrative in such a way that it seems to be that a different dialogue and conversation is happening. And one of the things, and I know it's been called white fragility that happens, is that white people start to become delicate and collapse and either become overly defensive or are unable. And it's like, and I, you know, one of the things I've spoken about in some of the other interviews is when we first launched the conference and we started to get some pushback on the fact that we didn't have initially any Black speakers on the conference, which was not an intentional thing, but it was my education continues, was an enormous oversight reflective of the very issue that we're trying to speak about at this point. But it's easy when one has their own trauma, that when one feels attacked, they defend and they shut down. How do we, on both sides of this discussion, what supports dialogue happening in a way which actually allows things to move forward rather than people just retreating back into kind of the old habits and patterns?
Sure. Well, intercultural, interracial dialogue is not a level playing field. It's not a symmetrical conversation. And I hope that white people can appreciate that as anxious and uncomfortable you might be entering into that kind of hard conversation, that the opportunity costs for people who are racialized Black and brown to participate in it are much, much higher. And because we already understand how and why, if we are successful in changing racist ideas and racist policies at the cultural and institutional level, and maybe at the interpersonal and group level, that we can change society in a way that wins for everybody. But racial coding at its core is win-lose. So white people who have been coded as winners in the racial story have as an initial reflex when their comforts are called into question, to imagine that now they will have to lose. And I believe that racial justice in creating a win-win society means that we completely strip away that that dynamic, and that white people in particular get to understand that solidarity is self-interest. And where you feel empathic collapse, that is a diminishment of your humanity. You know, when you care but you don't care in your bowels, when it doesn't make you want to throw up the kinds of horrors that Black and brown people live through, then you're not sufficiently invested in the conversation. It's like the bacon and egg breakfast. The pig is committed and the chicken is interested. So white people tend to be interested in the race conversation.
I haven't heard that metaphor before. That's great. We haven't got so much time, but I also wanted just to come back to, where do we start? People that are watching this, listening to this, and feel impacted, include myself in that, of what does one do with that emotion? How does one start to live their life in a way which helps this issue progress and move forwards?
Well, you realize that you don't live your life alone, and you don't live your life with your demographic or zip code alone. You live your life in a global human community in which we have common problems and differential access to the necessities of life, and that white people have come to understand is their individual existence never existed. You've never been an individual. You've been an intervidual. You have always been caught in a seamless garment of destiny and an inescapable network of mutuality with people who whose lives provide a lift to yours without you knowing it. So race is not an intrinsic property. It's a relational property. So understanding how does whiteness relate to non-whiteness, and what responsibility does that involve, both to take initiative, to build your own understanding, rather than to leave that question to me. I would say, as I return the question to you, you're a grown-up, you have a good mind, you have research capacities, you have access to Google machines and public libraries and the Amazon UK bookstore with all of its recommendations. They'd be happy to sell you whatever you want. And if you go on Google just for your attention, they will educate you for free. So the main thing white people need is motivation. Black and brown people have been studying racism and race and white people for 500 years. It's about time you studied yourselves and realize that your survival is dependent on what you can finally at last learn about that, in part by joining the rest of the family, being in partnership with us, and accepting some instruction, because we've been studying you folk for some time. and take back your projection. We don't want to hurt you. Like Kimberly Jones said, watch the Kimberly Jones video. Just enter Kimberly Jones on the YouTube machine. And she will tell you that Black people around the world want justice, and white people should be relieved about that, because if we wanted revenge, things would be playing out a good deal differently. We don't. So you can be courageous. Yeah. You can afford to be. It's a good risk for white people to be racially brave.
I think it's a really important point, several number of points, but particularly a couple of points you just made, one of which is that it's not the job of black people to educate white people. It's a job of
but we will and we do educate
themselves. And I've devoted I know. My life to I realize that, but it's ultimately that the responsibility falls upon white people to actually take the time and to do the research. I think one of the things that you've spoken to very eloquently today is just looking at history and being a student of history. I think that that is very powerful. And I think one of the things that I've noticed over the last few weeks as I've been beginning on my journey of trying to better understand this is entering into dialogues such as this and other dialogues that haven't been recorded and dialogues that have been recorded, of sort of coming from a place of recognizing my own limitations and recognizing my own failings in this issue, and how much gentleness and softness I've been met by, as opposed to my deeper fear is that in coming forward in that place that that's going to be squashed on or attacked. And I think that that's a really a helpful, hopefully, thing to share, that actually certainly my experience has been both publicly and privately of coming forward and saying, I realize I don't understand this issue well. I realize that's my failing. How much actually love and kindness I've received in response to that, which has been quite touching.
Well, I think we're trying to speak from the top of the polyvagal scale, that we're remaining in social engagement when the default response to racialized conversations is to be in fight or flight. And even with an element of ambient freeze, sometimes acute freeze, and on the grass mat floors of the Satyagraha movement in India, which was a racialized, also liberation movement from British colonialism and the church basements of the civil rights movement, we were practicing, our ancestors were practicing how to remain in the social engagement circuitry, honoring our own dignity and honoring the dignity of those people who've been trained to oppress us, as we demand that our humanity be honored with the same level of deep and spontaneous sincerity that you'll honor each other's. And the secret of all this upheaval of the moment is to recognize that that social engagement circuitry is the driver of any real revolution, and that revolutions are not about justice ultimately, but about love and the mending of the fabric of the human family.
That's very true and very powerful. Victor, for people that want to find out more about you and your work, what's the best way for people to do that?
Well, I'm engaged in some courses on racial justice matters called Hard Conversations. So if you check out hardconversations.org, you can participate in our online Introduction to Racism course. Introduction to Racism and Its Undoing, I should say, Whiteness, Race, and Social Justice course, which is not only exclusively for white folk, but especially of benefit to white folk who want to understand how they have been racialized. And I also do trauma healing on a group coaching or individual coaching level. And you can reach me at radicalresilience.com or radicalresilience@gmail.com.
Victor Lee Lewis, thank you so much for this interview. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, thank you for letting me wander so freely through these matters with you.
Thank you.